Coffee in Space is a podcast by S. Daniel Smith that puts the best in established and up-and-coming science fiction and fantasy writers in front of you, their readers. Dan's goal is to help you learn more about who they are as people, how they write, and how they live. Whether you're listening to this podcast at home, or in your car, or somewhere in between, Dan hopes to transport you to the crew lounge on an intergalactic spaceship, where you can have a cup of your favourite coffee with science fiction and fantasy authors. So sit back, listen in, and enjoy the show.
Hi, everyone. It's Dan Smith again, the host of the Coffee in Space podcast. Welcome to another episode in Season 2. Today, we have Dr. Alan Robach joining us today to talk about climate change based on a nuclear war or nuclear winter, which would be the fallout of a nuclear war. I'm super excited to have an exchange with Dr. Robach, kind of find out some of the science that we read behind the fiction that we read. And I can't wait to really get in here and learn more about the climate changes that would be based on a possible nuclear war. So anyway, without further ado, welcome to Coffee in Space, Dr. Robach, and thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. Thanks for showing interest in my work.
Yeah, and I'll for the listeners, so this is kind of how we got started here. I was researching for a writing project I was doing about the Able Archer 83 exercise, where America came probably as, and I'll get your take on this actually here in just a few minutes, but where I think based on the research I've done, America came as close as it was going to come to pulling the trigger, and the Soviet Union as well. Some things had gone on leading up to that event. And so I think based on what I've researched that we were probably as close as we were going to be since at least the Cuba incident. And so I was doing some research there, and I happened on to the Rutgers site that maintains the list of all of your writing and your research credits. And so I reached out, folks, and Dr. Robach was good enough to kind of exchange emails with me. And so I just kind of on a whim thought, you know what, let's go deeper into the fact behind the fiction and get an idea of what. Because this is really pretty scary, right, sir? I mean, this is like this would be a big deal. Like, this is like all this dystopian fiction. Yeah, go kind of give us an idea of what is your baseline for studying climate change based on nuclear war?
I wouldn't call it the Cuba incident. I would call it the Cuban Missile Crisis. And I think that's where we came closest to the second nuclear war. It's been 75 years since the first nuclear war, when the United States dropped 2 atomic bombs on Japan, on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And I think we've been very lucky to have not had another nuclear war since then. We have come close a number of times. And if we did, it would be a global catastrophe.
Yeah. So give us an idea, kind of introduce yourself to the audience. I've alluded to the fact that you have done research that you're at Rutgers. Give us an idea of who you are and what your background is.
I'm a meteorologist. I got my bachelor's degree at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. I was in the Peace Corps for 2 years in the Philippines. Then I went to graduate school at MIT, where I got my master's and PhD in meteorology. That was a long time ago, in 1977. And since then, I've been doing research on climate change for my whole career. I was a professor at University of Maryland for 20 years, where I was also state climatologist of Maryland. And for the last 23 years now, I've been a professor at Rutgers University in New Jersey. So almost every year I go to the American Geophysical Union meeting, which is the largest meeting on the planet for scientists who study earth science, geology, oceanography, meteorology, climate change. In 1982, I saw that there was going to be a talk about the climatic effects of nuclear war. And I went to it, but it was canceled because some of the authors worked for NASA. NASA told them, NASA doesn't work on nuclear war. If you talk like that, our funding will be affected. So they decided to come up with, what should they call their work? And they called it Nuclear Winter, the cause and effect of this catastrophe. what they discovered was that if there was a nuclear war, there would be fires, and fires would produce smoke in cities and industrial areas. And there would be so much smoke, it would go up in the upper atmosphere, block out the sun, make it cold and dark at the Earth's surface, and this would destroy agriculture. Temperatures could get below freezing in the summertime. That would basically kill all the crops. So this could happen in a war between the United States and the Soviet Union. They published a paper called Nuclear Winter. I did some climate model calculations and got the same results. And Russian scientists did the same thing. Alexandrov and Stenchikov also published a paper along with this first American group, Turco, Toon, Ackerman, Pollock, and Sagan. The results were presented to Mikhail Gorbachev, who led the Soviet Union, and Ronald Reagan, who was the president of the United States. And the same answer was given to these leaders from both sides, and they decided it was real, it wasn't a propaganda, and they agreed to end the nuclear arms race, and the number of nuclear weapons has been going down ever since then. In fact, they almost decided to completely get rid of nuclear weapons. So since then, the number's been going down, but there's still about 10,000 nuclear weapons in the world. Now, Dan, I don't know if you know, how many countries have nuclear weapons?
I am actually not sure of that number. It's probably around 10, wouldn't you say?
Yes, that's very good. It's 9. And the United States and Russia have more than 90% of them, but there are 7 other countries with much smaller arsenals. And about 15 years ago at the American Geophysical Union meeting, I ran into Rich Turco and Brian Toon, and they told me they were starting to work on what would happen if India and Pakistan had a nuclear war. These are 2 countries on the other side of the world with quite small arsenals, and they calculated they would put 5 or 6 million tons of smoke into the atmosphere. And they asked me to do the climate model calculations. And so my student, Luke Oman, was working on volcanic eruptions and climate. We used the same climate model. And we discovered that it wouldn't be nuclear winter, that is, temperatures wouldn't get below freezing, but it would still be the largest climate change in recorded human history. The cooling would have major impacts on agriculture, and it would last for many years. And so ever since then, we've been trying to do a better job of understanding this and understanding what would happen if there was a war now between the U.S. and Russia.
And so do you find that most of your research, even now, still focuses on the holders of the 90% of the arms? Or is there more, because of proliferation and whatnot, is there more focus, whether with you or outside of you, but focus on the Indias and Pakistans, the North Koreas of the world?
Well, so there are 9 countries with nuclear weapons. I don't think there's a prospect for any other countries getting nuclear weapons soon. So we focus on those 9 countries and look at different scenarios of how a nuclear war might start and be fought between them. We think that, although we're not experts on this, we think that India and Pakistan still creates the greatest threat, because along the Kashmiri border, where they still have a dispute about who owns the land, quite often there are incursions and there are soldiers on either side that are getting killed, even as recently as this year, last year. And these are both nuclear armed states. And so we still have, and our first study showed about 5 million tons of smoke, but that was 15 years ago. More recently, we looked at it, and India and Pakistan's arsenals are growing, the number is growing, the strength of the weapons is growing, and the potential targets are growing. And so we now estimate that the effects would be much worse, that there might be 16, 27 million tons of smoke put into the atmosphere. And this would be a catastrophe for the world. Then the question is, all right, so if you have changes of temperature, changes of amount of rain, less sunlight, ozone depletion, which would enhance ultraviolet radiation, how would it really affect agriculture? So we've been working with crop modelers and presenting them with the scenarios of how the temperature and climate would change. And they've calculated how much food would be produced for the major grains that people around the world eat: corn, wheat, rice, and soybeans. And then we've worked with economists to see, okay, if the crop production goes down, how much food would actually be available? How would the prices change? How would there be famine in some parts of the world? And we're still in the middle of doing that.
I'll be interested in learning more about that as it goes comes along. For point of reference, and forgive me for kind of shotgunning you as far as questions are concerned, but can you compare the India-Pakistan numbers that you're running as far as how much tons of smoke is in the air to the Hiroshima and Nagasaki weapons, or has that research not been done?
No, sure. Hiroshima was the bomb that was dropped was 15 kilotons. It was the explosive power of 15,000 tons of TNT. So it was a huge bomb. You may have heard of the mother of all bombs that was dropped in the Middle East a year or two ago. That was 10 tons. So Hiroshima was 15,000 tons. It was 1,000 times stronger. And Nagasaki was 20 kilotons, 20,000 tons. What causes the climate change is the amount of smoke. So there was a firestorm that started in Hiroshima, and it pumped smoke up into the upper atmosphere. We don't have any observations of how much smoke there was. But I did a calculation. You may not know that the bombs dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki were the culmination of a genocidal plan by the United States Air Force to burn cities in Japan during the whole summer. Starting on March 10th, they sent over 300 planes over Tokyo and burned Tokyo. More people died, were burned to death in those 24 hours than any time before or since in the history of our planet. And every 3 days or so after that, they sent fleets of airplanes over the different cities in Japan, burning them. And Hiroshima and Nagasaki were the 68th and 69th cities to be burned. So, and they killed massive numbers of civilians. It was almost all civilians. And so this genocidal plan was already part of the story. It's just with Hiroshima and Nagasaki, it only took one bomb, not hundreds of them. So it was horrible. And the war ended soon thereafter. There's a big dispute about whether the nuclear bombs caused the end of the war or not. We won't go into that. But anyway, the war ended, and we haven't had a nuclear war since then. But now, nuclear weapons are much bigger than the ones dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Typical ones in the United States arsenal are 150 or 500 kilotons. So they would burn a much larger area. And we have thousands of them. The U.S. and Russia each still have about 6,000 nuclear weapons. And so the total amount of smoke that would be generated for a war between the U.S. and Russia would be 150 million tons of smoke. The amount that Hiroshima by itself put it in the stratosphere was probably not very much and probably didn't have any climate change because it was just one city burning. And Nagasaki, the bomb hit in a valley and it didn't burn as large an area as it did in Hiroshima. But we're looking at scenarios of 100 cities or 1,000 cities being burned, and that would produce large amounts of smoke. Our climate model simulations show that if you get black smoke up into the upper part of the troposphere, that's the layer where we live, the bottom of the atmosphere, it would be heated by the sun and lofted into the stratosphere, which is a layer above where we live. In the stratosphere, there's no rain, there's no clouds, and so it would stay there, be lofted, and stay for years and be blown around the world, last for a very long time. We've had evidence that this would actually happen recently from large forest fires. In British Columbia, 3 years ago, there was a forest fire that put about 0.3 million tons of smoke into the upper atmosphere. And in Australia, a year ago, in December and January, they put three times as much. And so we observed with satellites that smoke, once it got in the stratosphere, would be heated and lofted 10 or 20 kilometers into the stratosphere and be blown around the world. So we're talking about 10, 100 times as much smoke that would go in from a nuclear war.
And that's just because of the sheer number of exchanges that we're talking about, like, isn't that correct? I mean, we're talking about forest fires all around Australia versus 12,000 weapons or so being tossed at two major land masses.
Yeah, I don't like to use the word exchange. I think of exchange as like taking a present back to the store because it's a sweater because it's the wrong size. I think
that's fair.
These are sanitized words that people use who work on these horrific things so they don't go crazy thinking about it. But it would be, you know, burning women and children. It would be mass genocide. Nuclear weapons are weapons of genocide. They can't precisely target only military targets. There's something called the law of war, which militaries are supposed to follow. And that is, you aren't allowed to just kill people. You can only attack, if you're using violence, you can only attack soldiers or people in the military. And they say, we don't target cities per se, but you know, there's a funny five-sided building in Washington and there's all kinds of military targets in cities. And so in truth, many cities, almost all the big cities are targeted. And it would be the smoke from all the fuel in the cities, all the buildings, the asphalt, the contents of the buildings would burn. And we calculate how much smoke you would generate from these attacks.
How long do you think, based on your modeling, how long would a nuclear winter last with a full exchange? or sorry, I keep using the word, but a war. How long would it last?
It turns out a war between India and Pakistan, or a war between the U.S. and Russia, it would last about the same amount of time. The smoke would go up into the stratosphere, and it would last for climate change lasts for about 5 years. Severe climate change, and it would last for more than a decade. So if you put particles in the atmosphere near the surface, air pollution, it lasts for about a week. It takes a week for about 2/3 of it to be removed. In the stratosphere, it lasts for about a year. So it's one particle of smoke in the stratosphere is 50 times more effective at causing climate change. And so it would that's for volcanic aerosols. But smoke, which is absorbed by the sunlight and lofted to the upper stratosphere, lasts for 5 years. So there would be like a decade of climate change, and you would have 5 years with temperatures below freezing in agriculture areas of the U.S. and Russia if there was a war between the U.S. and Russia. So it would be mass starvation for the whole planet.
Yeah. So let's get to the fiction that maybe folks read. And I know, like, and this is a question I want to talk to you about later, but I know, like, nuclear war fiction isn't quite, you know, the cool thing or the end thing like it was back in the 80s and 90s, mm-hmm. probably. But I still read it. In fact, one of the first forays into science fiction for me was David Brin's The Postman and Neville Shute's On the Beach. And particularly for Neville Shute's On the Beach, it was shortly after a nuclear war. And, you know, so he's down in Australia. For those who haven't read the book, sorry for spoiling it. And nuclear winter is coming, and it's wiping out all of humanity. I don't think, if I've understood the research I've done, that it's going to work that way. But how would it affect, you know, a war between America and Russia would be mostly in the Northern Hemisphere. So how would it affect the Southern Hemisphere as far as climate's concerned?
No, it would affect the whole globe. Because the smoke would last for so long, it would be blown around the whole world. No place would escape. So right now there are no nuclear weapons in the Southern Hemisphere. But, and of the nine countries with nuclear weapons, there's the United States, there's England and France, and the other six are all in Asia. But it doesn't matter where the smoke goes into the atmosphere. Because it would last for so long, it would be blown around the whole world. So Australia would be affected just like the United States. The coasts of Australia are on oceans, and probably the ocean temperatures wouldn't cool as much as in the center of the land. So if you were in New Zealand, for example, the climate change would be a little bit less than in the center of Asia or the center of North America. But still, the whole world would be affected.
Now, is it purely climate, or is there going to be radioactive fallout at some point in the Southern Hemisphere?
Most people are afraid of nuclear war because of radioactivity.
Yeah.
The effects of radioactivity and the blast and the fires where the bombs go off. It turns out the radioactivity would not be global. It would be just downwind of where the bombs were dropped. So it depends on the wind that day. There would be these plumes 100 miles long or something. And so those areas would be contaminated. But the rest of the world, the radioactivity would not be the main problem. The main problem would be climate change. In the 1980s, after nuclear winter was publicized, the rest of the world said, you know, people in China said, you know, if there was a war between the U.S. and the Soviet Union, more people in China could die than in the U.S. and Soviet Union combined because of the climate effect, because there would be no food. And so there's huge pressure from the rest of the world to get the nuclear nations to stop the arms race and to reduce their arsenals. Recently, however, there's been another push. The International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, ICAN, organized non-governmental groups to push for a treaty to ban nuclear weapons. And they had three conferences on the humanitarian impacts of nuclear war. I attended two of them, and my colleague Mike Mills attended the third one. One was in Norway, one in Mexico and Austria. And we informed them about both the effects of radioactivity, the Hibakusha, the people that were actually in Hiroshima and Nagasaki and survived and saw the horror, talked about it. But also we talked about the climate change. And they were able to go to the United Nations 3 years ago and put through a treaty to prohibit nuclear weapons, the TPNW, Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. It comes into force after 50 countries around the world have ratified it. And a month ago, the 50th country ratified it. And so on January 22nd, 90 days after that, January 22nd, 2021, 2 days after Joe Biden and Kamala Harris are sworn in, this treaty will come into effect and nuclear weapons will be prohibited in the world. And so I feel really good that I was contributed to that to inform people. And it's the rest of the world telling the nine countries with nuclear weapons that we have to get rid of them. Those countries so far are pretending to ignore it and ignore the will of the rest of the people in the world. But that pressure is coming. And ICANN got the Nobel Peace Prize in 2017 for their work on doing this.
So I'm going to sound a little like a pessimist here, or a cynic, probably. I mean, I get it that 50 countries signed a treaty, but I mean, who's really going to tell America and Russia to get rid of their nuclear weapons?
In the United States, it's going to be the Americans are going to tell the government. It has to be something from, it has to be the will of the people. And in democracies, that's how it works. There were huge pressures in the 1980s, anti-nuclear rallies, SANE and all these other groups. And that pressure helped end the nuclear arms race. And for many other issues, it's pressure from the people. And so that's why it's important to educate people about what the effects are. I had the very surrealistic experience of being invited to Cuba to give a talk about nuclear winter by Fidel Castro. And I went there and I had a graduate student who was Cuban who went back to Cuba and he was the contact. And I went there and gave a talk for an hour and Fidel sat in the front row and listened to my talk and asked questions. And he then blogged about that we have to get rid of nuclear weapons. And Cuba was one of the first countries to sign the treaty on prohibition of nuclear weapons. And so getting information out about it is really important. So that they gave me a private walking tour of Havana the next day. And Fidel said, can we televise your talk? And the next day it was shown on nationwide television in prime time. And so I went into this hotel to see if I was actually on TV. And we went in, and there was a TV on, and there was a Julia Roberts movie on. And I said, could you change the channel? And sure enough, there I was giving my lecture. And what that taught me was a professor giving a lecture isn't the way to do it. You need a feature film where this beautiful scientist in St. Petersburg is collaborating with this handsome scientist in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. Meanwhile, on the Kashmiri border, the skirmish is starting and you can write the script yourself. There's a little bit of sex and a little violence and they save the world. And so I've been trying to get people to do a movie like that. I think that would be a much better way to inform people about it than me writing papers and giving lectures.
I mean, no offense to you. You're a handsome fellow, I'm sure. But I agree with you. talking about fiction a little bit here, and how it crosses over into real life. When you're watching the news and, you know, either North Korea is doing its, saber rattling again, or, you know, some other country is starting to get a little blustery, or some other situations getting a little blustery. Do you ever sit there and let your mind wander through scenarios, or do you ever get concerned when a country starts doing that, like India or Pakistan or us for that matter? Or do you just sit in the knowledge of what will happen either way?
I think because of our work on nuclear winter, the term nuclear winter has gotten more into the lexicon and people know about it. And no sane leader of a country would actually use nuclear weapons. If you think violence is a way to solve problems, we have precise guided cruise missiles that we can knock out whoever we want. So you don't want to have to kill everybody in the city. One nuclear bomb dropped on a city would kill more people instantly than all of COVID has killed so far in the United States. So it would be horrendous. A couple of years ago when Kim was doing saber rattling and Trump said, my button's bigger than yours, that's when I began to worry, because nuclear war, if it ever starts, would probably be by somebody who's crazy in charge of the weapons or by accident. There have been a number of cases where it looked like you were being attacked, but there was something wrong with the radar equipment, or in one case in the U.S., they put a training tape in and thought that it was real, and so they tried to wake up the president. And so once something starts and people panic, or there's misinformation, or somebody hacks into it, that's what I worry about. And I can't think of any sane way to actually use nuclear weapons. countries with them say, oh, we don't plan to use them. They're just for deterrence. They're to stop people from attacking us. But they don't deter war. There have been many instances where nuclear-armed countries have been attacked. Argentina attacked England during the Falkland Islands War. Israel was attacked in the Six-Day War. The Soviet Union took over Eastern Europe when the U.S. was the only nuclear nation. I mean, who won the war in Vietnam or the wars in Afghanistan? So they don't deter hackers. They don't deter pandemics. They don't deter terrorists. Oh, but they deter other nuclear nations. Well, it's true, there hasn't been another nuclear war since 75 years ago, but we don't know why that is. And so let's say you believe me, I'm going to attack you if you attack me. So, okay, you have to believe that I would be a suicide bomber, because if the United States attacked Russia and they didn't do anything, everybody in the United States would die because they would starve to death. So if you threatened to actually use nuclear weapons, it's self-assured destruction. It's not mutual assured destruction. And we're trying to educate the leaders of the world about what they can do about it. Now, Joe Biden is going to extend the New START treaty for 5 years, try to get back into the excellent treaty we have with Iran, which stopped them from proceeding to make nuclear weapons. But that's not enough. We have to declare no first use of nuclear weapons. All cards don't have to be on the table. But we also have to declare no second use or no third use. I mean, I can't think of a logical way to actually use nuclear weapons. Think of all the sophisticated countries that don't have nuclear weapons that could make them. Why have they chosen not to make them? A few of them think that they're protected by the American nuclear umbrella, but most of them have decided they don't want to make nuclear weapons. They'd be better off without them. And so that's the direction we have to go. And I think other international treaties to ban cluster munitions or to ban chemical warfare or biological warfare, every country didn't sign on to them. In fact, some of them have not been ratified yet, but still they set the standard for the world, and people have, that's become the norm, and people don't use them anymore. That's what I hope that what's going to happen with the treaty on prohibition of nuclear weapons.
Yeah, I think that is a good way to, a good parallel to draw, that the chemical weapons and the ground mines have been.
Landmines, yes.
Yeah, landmines have been not completely pulled out of inventories, but they aren't used as much as they were at one time. I think we got plenty of that in the 80s and 90s in Africa, where people started realizing that landmines were just horrific. And I appreciate the information you've been given. Let me ask this now. So I alluded earlier that, you know, nuclear war fiction is not quite the hot topic as far as science fiction and fantasy are concerned. I don't know how many of my listeners read it. I haven't read one in a while, although I have a couple on my list. Do you ever get yawns from people when you go talk about this? You know, kind of that's a bygone era, or people paying pretty good attention?
Mark Twain said, denial ain't just a river in Egypt. And that's the reaction a lot of people. When they hear something so horrific, they pretend they didn't hear it and pretend somebody else is going to take care of it, that there hasn't been a nuclear war for 75 years, so therefore there will never will be, and I'm not going to worry about it, let somebody else worry about it. And that keeps you sane, but my reaction is to try and do something about it. So I don't hear, nobody tells us that we're wrong, and we can't test the theory in the real world, but there are lots of things that happen, like the demise of the dinosaurs or volcanic eruptions or forest fires or other cities that have burned. I mean, San Francisco burned in 1906 after an earthquake, and there was a huge firestorm that pumped the smoke up into the atmosphere. And so we can test those parts of the theory. So no, the big question is, how much smoke would there be? If there's enough smoke, then the climate change is obvious, that nobody doubts that, because we have episodic volcanic eruptions that put particles in the atmosphere, and we can measure how much climate change you get, and we use the same climate models to calculate the effects of smoke. But people say, how can you spend your life worrying about thinking about such horrible things? And I say, well, I'm trying to prevent them. That's my goal. That feels good.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with that. That's a good life's work, I would say. Well, let me say this. For those who are interested in learning more about your research or even you as an individual, how can they learn more about what you've put together?
So my name is spelled R-O-B-O-C-K, and it's an unusual name. So if you type it into Google, the first thing that comes up will be my homepage. And you can click there, and there's links there to our work on nuclear war.
That's awesome. And then are you on any social media, or is it the webpage?
I'm on Twitter, at Alan Robuck, A-L-A-N-R-O-B-O-C-K, and I only tweet about nuclear issues, sometimes global warming.
Okay, well, I'll put both of those in the show notes. Thanks for being my guest today, Dr. Robuck. I've really enjoyed this talk.
Thanks for your interest.
Folks, thank you for listening to this. I hope that you have gotten as much out of this as I have. Go take a look at those links. Check out the professor on Twitter. Check out the webpage. I promise you, I've gone to this webpage, so I can tell you right now there's going to be a wealth of information. So whether you're using this as a writing tool, or more importantly, as a shaping tool for policy, check out Dr. Robuck's website and really get in there and pay attention to what you're reading, because it's very fascinating work. Once again, Doctor, thank you for being on the show today. I really appreciate your time.
My pleasure.
All right, everybody. Thank you for listening in. This is Dan Smith, and I will see you next time we get a chance to have coffee and space together.